Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. British Prime Minister Theresa May survived her no-confidence vote, but her Brexit deal will not do so well. So she's gone back to the leaders of the European Union asking for new concessions and getting very little traction. At the heart of the problem is the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU. Getting that right is way more than half the battle. But can she? We'll discuss this question with Fintan O'Toole. He's a journalist for the Irish Times and author of the new book, Heroic Failure, Brexit and the Politics of Pain. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
The Brexit vote, the referendum in 2016, is seen as having had an enormously divisive effect. What was behind the vote? What was behind the positive vote on the side of the English and the Welsh?
So, obviously, when you get something as large as this, there are going to be many factors feeding into it. But I think the biggest one is something that, and I blame myself as much as anybody else, we should have seen coming, and that nobody really saw coming, and it's English nationalism. Mm. If you look at the Brexit vote, it's very largely concentrated in non-metropolitan England. So if you take out London and one or two of the other major cities, London from the Cotswolds and the Tory shires up to the old steel towns, the old working class heartlands, all of those parts of England are the places in which the Brexit vote is 65, 70, even 80%. Mm-hmm. And the reason we should have seen this coming was because something extraordinary was happening that was happening quietly, but nonetheless was really showing up very much in social surveys, which was that the English were beginning to assert themselves as a political community. They were beginning to say, actually, you know what, this British thing, we're not that interested in it anymore. We want to be English again. And nobody paid much attention to this because no political party was driving it. The media were largely ignoring it, so it wasn't like it was something that was, people were being told to feel. So it was organic, and it was coming out of, I think, in retrospect, things that we should have expected. The English are a very proud nation. They a very long history. Arguably, England was the first functioning nation state in the world. Mm. In our terms, going right back to the 14th century. They had a language, they had a set of customs and laws, they had all the things that you would associate with nation state very early, and a very strong, proud identity. Why are we surprised that it's coming back? Well, we're surprised because it did an extraordinary thing in a way. It sort of faked its own death. It rolled itself into two other constructs, one of which was the Empire, of course, mm-hmm. and the other of which was the Union with Scotland, Wales, and Ireland from 1800. And Englishness was sort of contained within these other structures. So if those two structures change, well, then you would expect Englishness to reemerge. And the Empire is gone. Not everybody knows it, but it is gone. And the Union began to change radically in the late 1990s. Two big things happened late 1990s, the Belfast Peace Agreement in Northern Ireland, 1998, and the following year, the Scottish Parliament was established. Mm-hmm. And what you begin to see coming up really in surveys into the beginning of this century is the English withdrawing mentally from the Union. And we should have seen this. The 2011 national census, the last census that was been taken in the UK, a large majority of people in England offered the choice, what do you think of yourself as British, British and English, or English? A large majority said English only. Mm. Mm. And they also, the big surveys were asking things like, who represents England? Who should make the laws for England? The most basic questions. Do you think it's okay that Westminster, the Union Parliament in Westminster, makes laws for England? No. Suddenly, the English are saying no. In 2012, big survey asked that question. Do you think the status quo where Westminster makes the laws for England is okay? 24% of English people said, yeah, it's okay. The status quo was okay. Three quarters of them were saying, I don't want my laws for me as an English person made in Westminster. This is extraordinary stuff. And we weren't paying attention to it because, as I said, there was no political movement, there was no real media attention paid to it. But this was going to emerge somewhere. And it emerged in a kind of frustration that nobody's listening to us. Nobody pays attention. Nobody's even naming the fact that we think of ourselves as a political community and want to be recognized as such. And the first opportunity that the English got to give somebody a kick and say, pay attention to us, was the Brexit referendum.
Was this, yep.
And therefore, in retrospect, it's not that surprising that they took that opportunity to say, we want to be paid attention to. Mm-hmm. The irony is that Brexit actually doesn't answer any of those questions. You know, yeah. It really doesn't meet the needs that were there. But I think this is an underlying force and one we're still grappling with. What are the implications of the rising of English nationalism for Scotland, for Wales, for Ireland? Because, of course, we've all been intertwined for so long mm-hmm. that if this is happening, it's seismic in terms of all of those relationships yeah. within the islands.
So this resistance to integration there are some real world anxieties. You've had the Eurozone yeah. crisis, the economic crisis, that sense of contagion when you're integrated. Immigration was a large issue. Were there others that were literally sort of issue-oriented that drove it as well
so,
and fed the sense of resentment?
Yes. So I think there are... one of the big things that's underlying it is, particularly coming from the right, you know, the right being of the Tory party, is... You always have to remember there's a very strong agenda to, in a way, complete the agenda of Thatcherism. You know, that Thatcherism, this market philosophy, this breaking up of the state, handing over the public services, particularly the health service, all of those kind of things to market forces, was never completed. Mm-hmm. And the European Union is seen as a kind of super state and are therefore a constraint on the final Thatcherite destiny. So coming from a very influential section of the Tory party, you've got that driver. But it meets something completely different, right? Which is, that's not what's appealing to the working class communities in Sunderland, for example, who are voting for Brexit. They want the opposite. They want a state to protect them. Mm-hmm. They want all of these public services. They want to feel the security. So Brexit is in this sense, yes, it's driven by all of these kind of things, but they're often complete opposites. And the key to the Brexit referendum was David Cameron's extraordinary arrogance in one very simple respect. What he could have done is he could have lifted the phone and he could have spoken to his good friend, the Irish Prime Minister at the time, Enda Kenny, and said, you guys do referendums. So in Ireland, we have a referendum about something almost every year. We have a written constitution and it can be changed by popular vote, right? So we have a referendum about almost every year we have a referendum.
It sounds like California.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't exactly. So we've had like really big ones. Like, you know, this year we voted on abortion, which is a really divisive issue and liberalized abortion laws. 2 years ago, we brought in same-sex marriage by referendum. So we know how to do this stuff. We know how it works. And it would have been really interesting if David Cameron had just said, look, okay, how does this thing work when you call a referendum? Like, what actually really happens? And the first thing Enda Kenny would have told him is, it won't be just about what's on the ballot paper. You know, a referendum gives people all sorts of emotional outlets, you know, to say, I'm really angry about this, and therefore I'm going to take it out on them, you know, in this moment. And there's a very simple way of dealing with this. You make each side write down, in great detail, what happens if you vote yes or if you vote no? If you vote to leave, what happens? If you vote to remain, what happens? The Scottish independence referendum was defeated in 2014 because whatever you think about Scottish independence or the Scottish Nationalist Party, which is in power in Scotland, they were very responsible about calling a referendum on Scottish independence. This is a big thing to do. We have to put it down on paper. Mm. And they produced a 900-page document about what independence would look like. Mm. And they lost it on that, actually, because that meant that there was a discussion In the course of it, where people said, actually, that thing you say on page 747 about currency arrangements isn't very convincing. You know, and you had a real discussion then about what are you actually saying is going to happen. The pro-leave side in the Brexit referendum had a completely free ride. They could say whatever they liked. They could make stuff up, which they did, about you know, there was going to be £350 million a week extra for the health service. But also, they didn't have to agree among themselves about what Brexit would look like. So you had a range of opinion about, you know, what kind of Brexit should you have. This is one of the reasons why it's become so becalmed, you know, as a project, because it didn't have... It's like a revolution with no revolutionary program worked out, you know. So, you know, the French Revolution, you kind of know there's things about liberty, equality, and fraternity you want to do, or the, you know, Soviet Revolution, you've got communism, or you have a very clear kind of program. It may not be, in fact, fulfilled, but at least you kind of have an idea as to what you want to do. Whereas the Brexiteers are this kind of whole bunch of contradictions, very different kinds of impulses. You have ultra-free market libertarian people who have no problem with immigration, for example. And then you have a lot of the voters who said, I wanted to vote to get those people, those Polish people up the street. I want them gone, and I want them gone now. Yeah. You know, so you've got these very, very different kinds of impulses. So it's a sort of national revolution in a way, but a very incoherent and incomplete one, which really doesn't know what it wants. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't actually address a lot of the concerns of the people who voted for it. Yeah.
So take us to Northern Ireland and Ireland, and the implications of Brexit for that relationship. Northern Ireland voted to remain at, what, about 55-56% of the majority. It has had this soft border with the Republic of Ireland. Ireland remains part of the EU. Northern Ireland would presumably, as part of the United Kingdom, leave. What does that mean for the relationship? What does it mean in commercial terms? What does it mean? What will be the economic impact, for example?
So it's deeply disturbing and reckless. It's like somebody with very heavy boots going in and stamping all over your garden, you know, where you've got these very tender plants that are just beginning to grow. I mean, you'll all be aware that there was a 30-year-long, really, really, really vicious conflict that seemed interminable. That actually, for many of us who lived through it, you know, there was just a sense of despair that this because it was horrific, but not horrific enough in a way. It could continue. There was a phrase used by a British politician about an acceptable level of violence. Mm. You know, so you had this kind of obscenity of you know, a murder a day. You had this kind of awfulness in this very small community. You know, 1.5 million people. It's one of the great achievements of late 20th century diplomacy and politics to have actually solved that. You know, and in retrospect, it now looks like we were very lucky because we had a certain kind of confluence, like the stars aligned. You had Bill Clinton had come to power in the U.S. with all the confidence that Clinton had in his first term, you know, could do no wrong. Tony Blair came to power in Britain at the time when he was completely untarnished, had a huge majority, could do no wrong. The paramilitary organizations who had been driving the violence, the leadership in both sides had kind of reached a point where they were getting older, middle-aged. They were beginning to think, oh my God, are my kids going to go through the same stuff as I've gone through? So you had this, and then you had Irish governments. Ireland itself was modernizing in a lot of ways, liberalizing in a lot of ways. The old kind of very narrow nationalism was being challenged, and people were open to new ways of thinking. So these things aligned, and we got a peace process, which is absolutely not perfect, qualified in all sorts of ways, but it's utterly remarkable. I mean, it's a great human achievement. Mm-hmm. And it was an achievement that was primarily Irish and British. These two historical enemies, you know, worked together with absolute clarity and closeness to bring it about. But it was also underpinned by both the United States, which was really a kind of very important guarantor and friends throughout the process. Of course, Senator George Mitchell chaired the process with man should go straight to heaven. You know, I mean, remember when John Paul...
Not too soon.
They should make somebody a saint even while they're alive. You know, I think, you know, the patience
so
that
they
man,
could enjoy
the patience he showed to deal with all of this stuff was remarkable. And the European Union was a guarantor as well. So you had all these kind of things aligned. A very delicate process. And really what the process was trying to do was to say, look, you have a problem here, which is a historic problem, which goes back to, you know, well, you can count, you know, 700 years, 800 years, whatever beginning point you want. In order to solve it, you've got to do something really radical. You've got to stop thinking about identity as being monolithic. So if you ask the question, are you Irish or British? Do you want a united Ireland or do you want to stay part of the United Kingdom? You were only going to get polar opposite answers.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
You there was no meeting point. It was a zero-sum game. So the British used to always kind of superciliously joke about the Irish that whenever the Irish question was about to be solved, the Irish would change the question. And actually, changing the question was a really good idea, right? Which was, instead of saying, what is your identity and are you willing to die for it, you said, what could you live with?
Yeah.
What way of thinking about identity would be okay so that you could actually get back to some kind of normal life? And what it came up with was a very, very brilliant, delicate, complex arrangement, which said, everybody in Northern Ireland has a right to be, and this is the quotation from the agreement, it says, the birthright of everyone in Northern Ireland to be Irish or British or both, as they may so choose. Very radical rethinking of what identity means, right? Mm-hmm. Saying your identity might be multiple. It's a matter of choice. So therefore, it's in your head.
Yeah.
And because it's in your head, it could change. Yes. It's contingent. It's open. So this happened 20 years ago. We're marking the 20th anniversary of this year. And we all knew it was going to be a long-term process. So it was, first of all, about stopping the violence, letting that bitterness, letting that kind of awful cycle just stop. And that takes a while. And then trying to build some kind of trust, trying to build some sort of normality, getting people just kind of living an ordinary life. And after all of the suffering, Northern Ireland needed about 20 years of boredom, you know, just ordinariness, not being epic, you know, just getting on with ordinary life. And the fact that the border had more or less disappeared was a huge factor in this. So it just meant that if I get on the train, one of my earliest childhood memories is getting on the train from Dublin to go to Belfast. We used to go shopping in Belfast and smuggle things back because certain things were cheaper. We used to go up kind of thin and come back really, really fat because your mother would dress you in about four layers of clothing was cheaper. So they put on about four layers of clothing, you'd be really on the train. Say, Mommy, why do I have to wear all these clothes? but you know, I vividly remember the train would stop on the border and the police would get on and they would search and they would look at you and, you know, and it was a very hostile kind of thing. So the border itself was a source of conflict. It didn't just sort of represent the conflict, it actually sort of drove it in a way, because people had to be conscious of it all the time. Now, when I go on the train, I struggle to remember where exactly was the point of the border. You know, I know, of course, broadly speaking, this is around where it was, but I can't even identify it anymore. Bizarrely enough, I say this to people and they think I'm making it up, but it's actually true. The only reason I know that I've crossed the border is my mobile phone pings and there's a message from a mobile phone company. And I swear to God, I'm not joking. The message says, you are now roaming in Europe. this may sound very banal. It's just about ordinary life, but that's the entire point of it, right? It allows businesses to function. Huge numbers of businesses function cross-border, particularly agricultural food businesses, you know. One of the things you have to remember, if you don't know the Irish border, there's no particular reason why a lot of you should. I'm sure some of you are Irish would know it, but if you don't, let me just, I was promised to try to avoid numbers, but let me just give you two numbers, right? If you don't understand, it's just a very quick way of understanding it. One number is 137, and the other number is 208. 137 is the entire number of border crossings on the entire eastern flank of the European Union. So if you go from the Baltic all the way down, you know, all the way down through Moldova, Russia, you know, down to Turkey, there are 137 border crossings in that vast terrain. On the Irish border, there are 208 official border crossings, right? There had to be a team of civil servants, joint team of civil servants from North and South with Brexit, try to figure out how many border crossings are there. They came up with 208. But everybody knows that it's actually an infinite number because in a lot of cases, it's somebody's field. It's a little stream that you can put two planks across. You have to remember, this was never designed to be a border. It's if it was, you would, you know, if you were designing boards, you would fire the people who came up with this one, because it squiggles around all sorts of things. You could be driving along and you may have crossed the border 5 times without knowing it. You know, it just goes all over the place. The reason is because it was never meant to be a border. It was supposed to be a kind of temporary arrangement. When the island was partitioned in 1921, there was this kind of, well, very disputed agreements that the six northeastern counties would remain part of the United Kingdom, with the Protestant majority who wanted to be part of the UK, and the 26 other counties, which were Catholic majorities, would form the Irish Free State, which became the Irish Republic. And the border question was kind of left over, because people said, actually, it's very complicated. Why don't we set up a border commission, a boundary commission, as it was called, and we'll work out a proper border? And they spent 5 years doing this, and they couldn't agree. So the status quo just remained in place with this kind of crazy border. And in a way, it sort of didn't matter too much, but now it matters. So what you're now saying is that this border, which was never meant to be a border, which is unpoliceable, uncontrollable. Remember, the British during the Troubles, the British had, well, at any given point, I mean, they had 10,000 troops on the border, but at some points, 30,000 troops on the border. Helicopters, watchtowers, very sophisticated technology could not stop the IRA from taking, you know, bombs, bullets, guns, whatever, across anytime they wanted, you know. Because we know it's an unpoliceable border. It's the most porous border as you can possibly imagine. And you're now proposing with Brexit to make this border not just an international frontier, but a frontier between a block of 27 countries and an outside country. You know, so something that has never, ever been in its history and could never have been envisaged by anybody. And so this is deeply reckless, because it sort of says, you know, that thing you've been doing over there, you Irish people, well, actually, you know, we don't care about it anymore. And we're going to stop it. And this is not me as an Irish person saying this. There's two pieces of research. They asked Leave voters, there was a big survey. The people who voted Leave were asked the question very directly, would the destruction of the Irish peace process be a price worth paying for Brexit? 83% of Leave voters said yes. Absolutely. And there's another survey just out last week which says pretty much the same thing. It asked Conservatives, members of the Conservative Party, would you be prepared to destroy the Irish peace process to have Brexit be a success? 80% yes. It's absolutely extraordinary. And I don't want to be emotive about it. I don't want to blame people about it, but it is an act of extraordinary recklessness, you know, to say, actually, we don't really care what's going on over there. And of course, the irony of this is it's kind of saying you people are foreign, even while at the same time insisting you're part of the United Kingdom. This is Britain's own territory. This is not, you know, it's not somewhere off in the mid-Atlantic. You know, this is a place that Britain claims to be an absolutely integral part of its own territory. So there's a kind of recklessness here. There's no thought about it. There's no real plan. And so what the Irish government has had to do is to say, look, we can't trust you on this. You know, it looks very simple. Everybody is saying there cannot be a hard border, you know, including the British governments, European Union, the Irish governments. Everybody's saying can't be a hard border. You can't go back to that. So that looks very simple if we all agree. What's the problem? And the British are saying, look, just trust us on it. We'll work out something. After we've done the deal with the European Union, and we're going to get this fabulous deal, and it's going to give us, you know, we're going to have cake and eat cake, and everything is going to be just wonderful. So, of course, there'll be no border. It'll all be fine. And the Irish government, I think reasonably enough, has been forced to say, look, we can't take it on trust that it's going to be fine. This is a really serious matter for us. I mean, this is an existential question for us. And you have no plan here. You have absolutely no sense at all of how you're going to achieve this thing that we all agree we must achieve. So this is where you get this, I won't bore you with all the bureaucratic language, but this, the backstop you may have heard of, which is the thing that's now stopping Brexit, which is the European Union European Union, not just the Irish government, but the European Union in concert with the Irish government is saying, there can be no agreement with Britain. We're not doing any deal with you until you have a guarantee about the fact that there will be no Irish border. And not a sort of trust us about this, but an actual legal international guarantee. It has to be placed in stone as something that and what the Irish and the Europeans are saying is, look, if you can come up with another solution, fine. Absolutely. You know, if you think there's some magical technological solution that you can have a border between the European Union and Britain that has no infrastructure at all, that never existed in human history before, would you think you can do it? Well, fine. We're all delighted with that. But all we're saying is, if you can't, there's a fail-safe, which is that you're guaranteeing that there won't be one. And therefore, you're going to have to do certain other things. And of course, the other things mean that really the only way that I think this can work still is if the UK has a very soft Brexit, if it stays within the European Customs Union and in large parts of the single market. But of course, that's exactly what it's saying at the moment, that it will not do. And that's why the talks are in such a quagmire. I mean, they've been unable to move forward. And it's all about the Irish issue. You know, right. The Irish issue is absolutely central to the whole thing. And it's a great example of the return of the repressed. You know, if you don't talk about it, if you ignore it, it's going to come back and bite you. And that's really what's happening with the Brexit process now.
And so what are the chances then of a compromise in which Northern Ireland can in fact be sort of separated off from Brexit, be allowed to be part of the EU, even though it's part of the United Kingdom?
So The EU, to be fair to it, and I've often been a critic of the EU, but it's actually been pretty extraordinary on this issue. So the EU negotiation, Michel Barnier, who's leading the team, and really everybody from the European side has spoken about this, has said, but Barnier said it simply, that there are three things the British have to sort out before we can get into talking about the final deal, what the relationship's going to look like. People, money, Ireland. People is just mutual rights between, you know, citizens of the UK going to be living in European Union countries, what are their rights, and vice versa. You know, complicated bit of to-ing and fro-ing, but it's normal diplomacy, right? It's the sort of stuff that negotiators do. It's fixable. It's pretty much agreed. Money was the divorce bill, right, which was how many ongoing commitments does the UK have to the European Union budget, and what does that translate it to in terms of money? It translates into about £40 billion sterling. It's fine. It's done. You know, that's kind of agreed. Ireland is the one that's not agreed, right? For all the reasons we've been talking about. And I genuinely think the British thought, look, the Irish are kind of small. You know, when it comes to it, when is the big kind of, you know, the last minute summit, the way these things are done, we'll just fudge the Irish thing. Come on, you know, who cares? You know, there'll be a formula of words. And I think they miscalculated really fundamentally about this. You know, they thought Ireland could be bullied. But they also thought the European Union would say, oh, the bloody Irish, let's forget about it. And in fact, this has not happened. There hasn't been a single cigarette paper between the Irish position and the European Union position. So what the European Union has done is it's been very generous. And it said, look, Brexit's really difficult for us. We're a rule-bound organization. The European Union is just a set of rules. And if we start playing fast and loose with those rules and say, well, you can do a bit of this and you can do a bit of that, the whole thing will collapse. However, they've said, look, Northern Ireland is kind of, first of all, they've suffered a lot, right? It's a part of the world that's had a really hard time. Secondly, it's small. It's 1.5 million people. It's not going to threaten the entire structure of the European Union. So let's be generous. Let's say, in your case, you can have the best of both worlds, right? We're not saying you have to leave the UK. So therefore, legally, in sovereignty terms, you'll be leaving the European Union. However, you can continue to act as if you're in the European Union. And one of the reasons they've done this is because it's a very hard thing to remember, but under the peace deal, 1998 peace deal, every single person in Northern Ireland has an absolute right to European Union citizenship that cannot be changed by Brexit. Why? Because they have a right to Irish citizenship. So if you can be Irish or British or both, the legal manifestation of that is you're entitled to an Irish passport, you're entitled to Irish citizenship. And therefore, because nobody thought about this at the time, because the idea that they would be leaving the European Union never arose. But the implications of it now are that you have this 1.5 million people who have an absolute right to European Union citizenship. It cannot be taken away from them. It's guaranteed in international law. The Belfast Agreement is not just an internal document. It's an international treaty registered with the United Nations. It's a full piece of international law. So how do you vindicate the rights of this 1.5 million people who are going to remain European Union citizens outside the European Union? So the European Union has actually been quite generous and said, look, we'll, you know, whatever works, we'll do. There cannot be a hard border. This is just, you know, this would be doing violence to the peace process. We're not going to allow that. So what they've said is, look, why don't you just have like a very backroom kind of arrangement whereby goods moving between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK, so the islands of, you know, well, Northern Ireland there, the islands of Britain. So if you're moving to Scotland or you're moving to England with goods going back and forward, you could have checks. And the key word the European Union has been using is de-dramatizing. It's of course, Brexit has its own language now, of course. And de-dramatize just means, look, let's not make this a big issue. Let's just try and get it down to really kind of boring bureaucratic detail, which is what these people do very well. You know, let's find a way that a customs official in Liverpool could go and look at a ship that's going to Northern Ireland and say, actually, that stuff is fine, but that stuff doesn't make the rules. You know, so let's do it. Nobody would ever be aware of this. I mean, this stuff happens anyway. This kind of checking goes on anyway. So just you'd have more of that. They're even saying this could be done by British officials. You know, we'll work out a way to do this. The problem is that at the moment, the British government's history is an awful joker. You know, it throws in these kind of hand grenades just when you don't need another one. So just with all the Brexit stuff going on, of course, Theresa May called an election in 2017, thinking she would win a massive overall majority, lost seats, is now in a minority position. And the joke of history was she's being propped up by a small party from Northern Ireland, which is the Democratic Unionist Party. It's the most, historically, the most extreme Protestant Unionist party. It has 10 members of parliament, not a huge number, but that 10 hold the balance of power, and they're keeping Theresa May in office. They're saying, if you do anything like what the European Union is proposing, however de-dramatized it is, it makes Northern Ireland different from the rest of the UK. If you've got checks going from Britain to Northern Ireland, you're saying we're different, we're not the same as every other part of the UK. That's a threat to our unionist identity, and we will bring down your government if you do this. And that's what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. So the only solution to this, right, is what the European Union is suggesting. There's really no other way of doing this, right, which is just, if you don't want to have a hard border on the island, there has to be some kind of check outside the island. But at the moment, so that's kind of conceptually, I think, accepted by everybody, but politically, it's currently looking impossible. The very small thing, but the DUP, this Unionist Party from Northern Ireland, yesterday voted against the government on a relatively harmless bill, but it was kind of a shot across the bow saying, this is what's going to happen if you continue with this. So really, this is going to come to a head in the next 2 weeks. It has to, just with the way that time is moving. And so either Theresa May is going to blink and say, yeah, we accept the European Union's proposals on this, and risk the wrath of the Democratic Unionist Party and some of the real hardliners in her own party, which will create a political crisis in Britain, or the talks are going to fail. You know, we're actually getting to a point where a no-deal Brexit is still possible. And it will be the Irish question that will have led to that. The irony here is nobody in Ireland wants a no-deal, because right. we're collateral damage and all this sort of stuff. We don't want to cause Britain any harm of any kind. We genuinely don't, you know. I mean, even in spite of all the years of bitterness and everything else, that's all gone. There's a mutual interest in having a rational working deal. But at the moment, it's politically very difficult to see how that emerges.
Mm-hmm. We've been hearing from Fintan O'Toole of the Irish Times. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Brexit, The Politics of Pain. After the break, we'll consider what Brexit tells us about the crisis of English identity. Thank you. listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We are in conversation with Fintan O'Toole. He's a journalist for the Irish Times, but he's also the author of the forthcoming book, Brexit, The Politics of Pain. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our conversation.
So the Conservative Party has met recently. We're moving into an EU summit. What is Theresa May up against, both from her own, starting with from her own party?
So she has two great enemies. One is time. Enemy to us all, really, as you can see with my balding head. But she made a huge tactical mistake. I mean, just an enormous mistake, where she started the process. So the process of leaving the European Union is a legal process. And the country that's leaving starts the clock. They file Article 50, it's called. They say, we want to leave. And then you've got 2 years to negotiate. There was no need to do this immediately. It was done very quickly after the Brexit vote. It would have been perfectly reasonable to say, look, this is a really complicated thing. We've been enmeshed in this for 45 years. We're not going to get out of it quickly. It's a very complicated thing to do. But in the euphoria of Brexit, there was all this kind of sense of this is our moment of national liberation. Let's do it quickly. It's going to be easy. It's going to be the easiest trade negotiation in history, according to David Davis. Now, having started the clock, the problem is that the time is just running out, and she concentrated entirely on appeasing her own Brexit ultras. And then they find themselves with really only a couple of weeks, practically speaking, to get to a deal. So Brexit happens at the end of March 2019. But the deal has to be ratified by the British Parliament, by the European Parliament, and effectively it has to be signed off by every member state of the European Union. So getting to a deal is only one part of it. So really, if there's not a deal by the end of November, at the very latest December, but even that's kind of really pushing it, the whole thing collapses and there's no deal. So that's one of her enemies. The other enemy then is exactly the fact that she started out by taking the hardest possible line. Mm-hmm. She wanted to be in power, and she saw the way to power as the path of least resistance within England, which was to go for a really hard Brexit. This kind of macho, we're going out on our own, we're going to reestablish a great mercantile trading empire. All the countries of the empire just dying to get back into bed with us. We're the mother country. They love us. The Americans still love us, and the Australians love us. And everybody just wants to kind of do deals with us. And it's all going to be lovely and easy. And therefore, we can tell the European Union to basically go and stuff it, go and whistle, as Boris Johnson said. And then you've had this very slow realization, of course, that, it's a very simple question. Geography is destiny. Britain is an island off the continent of Europe, and no technology has yet been found to sort of change that, right? And so it has to have these relationships. It has to have these very, very close relationships. And no work really was done in terms of thinking about how this was going to happen. Rhetorically, they've built up this kind of head of steam for a really hard Brexit. You have a large group of backbench MPs. You have Boris Johnson, of course, who's resigned from government in order to try to lead them, thinking that's the way to power. And so they're pushing for what they call a Canada-style deal, right? Which is basically, a Canada-style deal is just like what the European Union would negotiate a trade deal with any other third country, with a couple of extras on top. Now, the ludicrous thing about this is that it doesn't address at all the reality of Britain's situation. Britain's not Canada. It's in Europe. Its trade, is 40% of its trade is already with the European Union. But also its trade with the rest of the world, remember, is done through treaties which have been negotiated via the European Union. There are 75 major trade treaties. So Britain, in this circumstance, is starting from scratch to say, let's negotiate trade. Now, I don't know, maybe some people here have been involved in trade deals. I haven't, but I've spoken to people who have. They take at minimum of 7 years. The Canada deal that they're looking for took 7 years to negotiate, you know, because they're incredibly complex. I mean, you're talking about, you know, light fittings and standards for, you know, the most extraordinary goods and services and all sorts of things. And so she's being pushed in this direction. She has realized that she has to compromise, right? So British industry is now saying, this is catastrophic. I mean, we're facing a possible catastrophe here. So I'm not going to too much data, but, you know, for example, the European aerospace industry, the only rival that Boeing has in terms of making planes, is essentially a Franco-British creation, right? So the Airbus planes are made in France and actually largely in Wales in around Cardiff, right? So every day, huge numbers of aircraft parts go from France to Cardiff and back every single day. You know, it's completely integrated supply chains. That's just one example. Nissan builds 500,000 cars a year in Sunderland, which voted for Brexit, right? This working class town voted for Brexit. Its biggest employer is Nissan, the Japanese car maker. Nissan brings in, and I had to myself, when I saw this figure, I thought, oh, that's wrong. I had to actually go back and check, you know. But it's actually true. They bring in 3 million parts a day. Not a week, a day. They bring in 3 million parts a day. They are, as all of these big companies are now, they are fully integrated supply chains, right? And it's all just in time. Nissan has half a day's stores on hand in Sunderland. Mm. Half a day. Mm. After half a day, the plant closes down. Now, if you are saying those 3 million parts have to be checked every day, it's just impossible. It just cannot be done. So the head of Nissan recently came out and said, look, we didn't say this during the Brexit referendum because we didn't think it was going to pass. Mm. You know, we just thought if we interfere, we'll be accused of, you know, trying to frighten people and everything else. But I'm really sorry. We would just have to close. I mean, we just cannot, you know, we just can't do this. You know, we've invested billions in this. We don't want to do this. You know, this is a state-of-the-art plant. It employs enormous numbers of people. It really works. It's fantastic. We're delighted with it. But we cannot be having tariff and non-tariff barriers for 3 million things going in and out every day. That's never mind the actual cars that are produced, right? This is just in terms of process. And this is, British industry is saying, we are facing a catastrophe. If there's no deal, all of this stuff comes to a halt. People are out of work. There's an enormous kind of economic hit. What are the political consequences of that? Who knows? However, what hasn't happened is that nobody, including Theresa May, has built up the political authority to say, come on, folks, get real here, you know. In these processes, every revolution always has, you know, fantastic utopian ideas. It's all going to be great. It was those people who were stopping us from being wonderful. And as soon as we get rid of those people, everything's going to be wonderful. That, you know, that's the basic narrative of a revolution. And then somebody has to come along at some stage, Napoleon or whatever, and say, you can't keep doing this. You know, some kind of rationality has to be applied here. And the problem is that Brexit undermined political authority to such an extent in London that there's now nobody, I mean, not the government and not the opposition. So the Labour Party, which is the alternative government, is also completely divided about Brexit and is afraid to really say anything very much. Mm. So what you have is you have a situation in which there's a real need for pragmatism and for a sort of genuine patriotism of somebody who says, look, this is self-harm. It's not in our interest to continue to try to do this stuff at this level. Somebody has to come in and say, there's going to be all sorts of compromises and you won't like some of them. That's what pragmatic life is like. And Theresa May is the person who's going to have to say that, but she hasn't prepared herself to be in that role. So she started out taking this very extreme position. And over the next 2 weeks, she's going to have to come out and say, look, would you people ever just shut up? You know, I'm really sorry, but you can't keep doing this kind of crazy, you know, nationalist revolution stuff. This is people's livelihoods. This is the future of the country. This is real stuff in real people's lives. And we have to speak honestly to them and say, as your leader, I am not going to lead you off a cliff. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And we don't know yet whether she has the authority to do that. You know, and this is an extraordinary situation. I can't think of anything we've ever seen like it. I don't know if you remember, just finally, the Brexit movie, if you ever go back and want to look at and understand Brexit, is The Italian Job with Michael Caine. It's absolutely fascinating. It's all about going into Europe, and so kind of a very, very strange film. But I don't know if you remember where it ends up. It ends up with they steal all the gold from Turin, the Italians, and their buses, they put it onto a bus, and then they're getting away. And they're going, you know, through the Alpine passes, and then they take a wrong turn, and the bus is left perched over the cliff, and it's going like that. And the gold is on one end, and all the crew of criminals are on the other end. And if they move towards the gold, the bus will go off. And if they don't move towards the gold, then the whole thing is pointless. And that's exactly where Brexit has ended up, right? So, you know, they can't move forward to get this prize that they want, and they can't get out of it. It's a really extraordinary situation.
So is this loss of authority on everyone's part, I mean, on all parties' part, is that the greatest danger?
Yes. And it's the problem for us in Ireland is it's a danger for us too, of course, because, yes, you know, we have no say in this. We cannot influence what happens in Britain itself. But it's a real lesson to us, I think. We all quite rightly, you know, I'm a professional agitator. You know, I try to make people question how power is being used and how politics is working and all those kind of things. And it's an absolute democratic duty to do that, you know, and that's what an engaged democracy is like. And I'm not being supercilious about the people who voted for Brexit. They engaged in a political choice. But that has to be balanced by a sense that actually we all depend on political structures that we may criticize and we may dislike, but we cannot destroy those political structures without being very careful as to what takes their place and what kind of institutions might work for us. And the institutions themselves have to have some democratic authority. What happened in Britain was they used a democratic mechanism that is not part of their culture, referendums. If you look at the entire history of political self-consciousness in England in particular, it's about the sovereignty of Parliament. That's what, you know, English history is about that. Mm-hmm. And to turn around, and one of the most critical existential questions that you faced in your modern history, and say, actually, this is not going to be done by Parliament, it's going to be done by a popular vote. That's fine if you think that through. How are we going to follow through on that? But they haven't done that. So they've placed authority in this sacred moment, June 23rd, 2016. That moment, the people spoke. But what did the people say? You know, they said, we don't want to be in that thing. that's fine, but it doesn't really get you very far. It doesn't tell you how you're going to do this and how you're going to do it with least self-harm. I mean, in my view, it's a crazy decision. I talked to a guy who was a very old trade union negotiator, and he said to me, and he's a very pro-British guy, and he said, you know, there were only three possibilities. He said, if you're going into a negotiation, you know, as a Labour leader, right, you say, you know, what do I want? And in this case, there were only three possibilities. One was the status quo, which they had rejected. The second was something better than the status quo, which the European Union could not possibly give a leaving member. I mean, if you can leave a club and have all the benefits outside of it, then the club is gone, right? And this is literally, the European Union would dissolve in 5 years. If Britain ends up with something better than the status quo by leaving, European Union's gone. So you couldn't get something better than the status quo. And so the only thing left is something worse than the status quo. And who in their right mind would want that? But that's effectively what they're stuck with. And then you need a political authority to say, let's make it the least worse than the status quo it can possibly be. Let's limit the self-harm as much as we possibly can, and so that the whole thing doesn't go crazy, and maybe down the road we're in a position to rethink it. My deep, deep worry is that nobody is exerting the moral imperative, actually, of standing up and saying, you may hate me for this, you may think I'm a traitor, you may think I'm weak, but I love my country And what I love about my country is that it's a rational democratic society, which Britain is. And that in a rational democratic society, you have to look at self-harm and say, exert your moral authority and say, look, you, whatever you think of me, the best I can tell you is that we're going to end up with a compromise that you won't like, but that will preserve those jobs, that will keep us on some kind of even keel, and that will limit the amount of harm that we do to ourselves and to others. I hope that Theresa May finds it somewhere in herself to be able to articulate that for the British people. And she's going to have to do it over the next few weeks.
Yeah. Two of the question cards that have come up from audience members ask the question of what would happen were there a second referendum. Is that wise? Would that be reckless? Would those who voted for Brexit feel betrayed? What would be the impact?
So a second referendum is often talked about as very undemocratic, you know, and in one way it's a good argument. I would suggest it's not undemocratic for three reasons. One is that if you can't change your mind, you don't live in a democracy. Changing your mind is the essence of democracy. If we couldn't change your mind, you'd have Donald Trump here forever. secondly, the 2016 referendum was itself a second referendum. This is completely forgotten. Nobody refers to this at all in the discourse about this. But there was a referendum in 1975 in the UK, which was to be the once and for all decision, are we in or out? And it was passed by 66% to 33%. I mean, the British voted to be in the European Union. So at the very least, you could say, well, best of three, perhaps, you know. But thirdly, there was, you know, for the reasons we were talking about, there was no real content to the question that people were asked. It was a pure negative, right? There was no positive content to it. And so it does not seem to me to be at all undemocratic or unreasonable to say, okay, this is what you voted for. This is what it looks like. Mm-hmm. It's a negotiated compromise, and this is what it looks like. Now, your question is, what would happen in it? I don't know, because it would depend a lot on what the question was. Mm-hmm. Is the question, here's the compromise. Do you want this or do you want no deal? Or is the question, here's the compromise. Do you want this or do you want to stay in the European Union? Mm-hmm. They're two very different kind of mm-hmm. questions. So it might even have to be a two-stage referendum, believe it or not, where you have the three options on the ballot paper the first time, which says, take this pretty messy deal, go out, crash out with no deal, or stay in. And then a runoff between the top two options. Right? It's a messy process. I'm not saying it's not. To me, it's the only way out of this mess that's been created, because exactly as you said in your question, you know, whatever happens, a lot of people are going to feel betrayed. You know, you can't take this genie out of the bottle and then just stick it back in. They've done it now. My view is that Brexit is always going to be an ex-Brexit. Brexit ceased, really, it died on the day it was born. Why? Because it was completely impossible to fulfill in the terms it had been framed. Remember, it was framed as, this is really easy, it's no problem, we're going to have all the benefits, all the existing benefits of European Union membership without being in the European Union. Right? So that's fine up to the point at which you actually vote to have it, and then it just falls apart immediately. It's like, you know, you ever see a film of Fellini's Roma where they're digging and there's beautiful frescoes and they open up, they find these things underground and then as they're filming, the air comes into the chamber and the things just disappear, you know, and it's like that. It's always in the past, oddly enough. There was one bright shining moment, which was, you know, between say 5 a.m. and 6 a.m. on that morning, you know, when it was, hey, it's independence, all fantastic, it's all great. And you think, what have we done? I don't know if you remember even looking at the faces, maybe you didn't really pay attention here, but if you saw Boris Johnson, for example, his face on that morning thinking, oh God, what have we done? You see, it wasn't supposed to happen. This is the key thing. For a lot of these people, it was a game. It was reckless. It was an Oxford Union debate. You know, me and David Cameron, we're rivals. I'll show him. You know, I'll do this. I happen to know happen to have had a conversation with Boris Johnson's sister and her husband, who were with him on the night before he came out to announce which way he was going to go in the referendum. And they said he changed his mind every hour. And if he'd walked out at a different hour, you know, he would have said, Britain's future is in Europe. This is our destiny. We don't run away from, you know, from Europe. We, you know, we're going to go in and change Europe, and the Europeans are lucky to have us, and, you know, all that. He would have done all that stuff. He had actually written, he's a columnist for the Daily Telegraph. By the way, never trust newspaper columnists. he had written two columns. He had to file his copy, and he wrote two columns. One is why we're leaving the European, why leaving the European Union is absolutely crucial to our destiny, and the other is why staying in the European Union is absolutely crucial to our destiny. That's the level of game playing, of recklessness, of lack of principle involved in this. So for a lot of people, who were kind of led into this by people like Boris Johnson. Johnson was a huge figure. I mean, if Johnson had gone the other way, Brexit would not have passed. There's no question. The polling evidence shows this very, very strongly. So the people who were led into this were kind of led in on false pretenses. You know, it's a way of kind of making a kind of gesture and having a bit of fun and sticking our two fingers up to the bloody Europeans, but it won't really happen. It won't have consequences. So I think it's reasonable for people to say, look, okay, these are the consequences. You can begin to see them now. Do you want them or not? A remarkable thing is that certainly anecdotally, but also some of the polling evidence is showing, quite a lot of people are saying, even if I lose my job, I want to do it. And we have to remember that nationalist revolutions are like that. They stir a certain kind of passion. So there's a lot of people who would vote again for Brexit, even knowing the damage it will do. And we have to accept that. You know, we have to accept that. I still think because it was so close, and a lot of people thought it would be very gentle. You know, it'd be just a kind of gesture. We'd still be more or less in the European Union. You know, and a lot of those people, I think, are saying, is this what we voted for? So my suspicion would be that it would be something like 55-45 to stay. That's what the polls tend to show now. But we don't know. And if they vote a second time, I think fair enough. You know, I mean, if knowing what it looks like, people vote that's what they want. That's an absolute democratic right that people have. But I think they have a right to make that informed choice rather than the kind of very nebulous, upbeat fantasy that they were offered.
Yeah.
And the British are a very proud people. You know, they really are. And I think all of this could have been solved, by the way. I think, you know, I said you shouldn't trust newspaper columnists, but if I'd been in charge, there was one thing I would have done, free advice to the European Union, which is before the Brexit vote, they should have said, we're expelling Britain from the European Union. We don't want you anymore. We hate you. You're terrible people. Go. Just get out of here. And Britain would have said, how dare you? How bloody dare you tell us that we're leaving? We have an absolute right to be in the European Union, and we won't take it otherwise. Would have solved the whole thing.
So please join me in thanking Fintan O'Toole.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Do visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Fintan O'Toole. He's a journalist for the Irish Times, and he's the author of a forthcoming book entitled Brexit, The Politics of Pain. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.